Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried. And some big changes have taken place in the Middle East. We have a ceasefire now in Lebanon. The genocide continues in Gaza. And now we have an invasion of Syria by Turkish-backed, US-backed, Israeli-backed jihadist forces. Death squads, basically, who are attacking Aleppo as we speak. And definitely on Israel's behalf. I don't think we need to dot such a large I. This is what's going on, and it's very imperative that we understand the strategic situation in West Asia right now. Because, of course, it all leads back to Palestine. This is all related to Palestine, what is going on there. And if we want to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians, we have to stand in solidarity with Syrian people, with Lebanese people. People in Yemen, people in Iraq, people in the entire region as they resist. And this is absolutely crucial. So I want to play a interview that Dimitri Lascaris did with Leif Maruf of Free Palestine TV. He did this on Reason to Resist, his program, just the other day. And it's just a brilliant interview, really unpacks the entire situation, very complex situation that's unfolding right now in the region. So I'm without further ado, I'm going to just get to that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Good afternoon. This is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you for Reason to Resist from Montreal, Canada on November 30th, 2024. I am happy to be joined again today by geopolitical analyst extraordinaire Laith Maarouf coming to us from Beirut, Lebanon. Laith is both an expert in broadcasting law and the executive director of Free Palestine TV, which has been doing vitally important reporting not only from Lebanon, but also from occupied Palestine. Thank you very much for joining me again today, Laith.
Good to be with you, Dimitri.
And first, let me say that I'm relieved and gratified to see that you and your family continue to be safe. You made it through this hellstorm, which may be over. We're going to get into that. But for the time being, you survived it, and you did that despite the fact that you took significant risks with your own personal safety in order to report what was going on in Lebanon. So thank you for that reporting, and we're so happy to see that you're safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Dimitri.
So Laith, something very important just happened a moment ago, and before I ask you about it, just to clarify how we got here, for those who haven't been keeping up to speed with events in Lebanon, in the early morning of November 27th, a ceasefire went into effect between Lebanon and Israel. Since then, there have been reports of sporadic Israeli attacks in Lebanon, but it seems that at a minimum, and at least for the time being, the level of violence has dropped considerably. Many Lebanese who lived in South Lebanon, I understand, are returning, those who were displaced by Israel's bombs. They're returning to their devastated communities. But interestingly, Laith, when the ceasefire went into effect, Hezbollah itself had not publicly committed to the ceasefire. Rather, the Lebanese government had committed to it and was giving assurances that Hezbollah was in agreement. And so therefore, because there wasn't a direct public embrace of the ceasefire by Hezbollah's leadership, there were questions as to what it actually intended to do in regard to the ceasefire and why it had done so, why it had to had agreed to it, if in fact it had agreed to it. Now, moments ago, you alerted me to the fact that the new Secretary General of Hezbollah, Naim Qassem, gave his first speech since the ceasefire went into effect. I understand you've watched the speech. Can you summarize for us what he had to say? And in particular, what did we learn from that speech about Hezbollah's view of the ceasefire, and particularly why Hezbollah has entered into it?
Yes, so the speech everybody was waiting for to understand the position of Hezbollah clearly, because there was a statement issued by Hezbollah that is written after the ceasefire came into effect, and it didn't mention even the word ceasefire in it or discuss it. So people were confused, to say the least, about what is the position of Hezbollah. And so to hear Sayyid Naim Qassem speak today, it finally brought clarity to everybody. And what he said is that this is a ceasefire signed on between the Lebanese government and the Western negotiators, and that it only entails a return to 1701, and therefore Hezbollah has nothing to say about it because it's only about the implementation of 1701. And so,
sorry, Laith, could we just pause there? Could you please explain to people what 1701 is, because not everybody might know that.
So 1701. Is the United Nations resolution that came into effect at the end of the 2006 war. And again, it was a Security Council resolution that was agreed upon by the Lebanese government to cease hostilities and to have the United Nations become put a force on the ground that stops the violations of sovereignty of both sides of the border. And as we have seen, of course, since 2006, this UNIFIL force never stopped the Zionists from violating the sovereignty of Lebanon tens of thousands of times over the span of those decade and a half since then. And so what we are seeing is, from the speech at least, what I could gather from this is that for Hezbollah, they didn't agree to anything. It is the state of Lebanon as the sovereign, which they support, have agreed to the return to 1701, which he described as a bigger victory for Hezbollah and a bigger defeat for the Israelis than even 2006, because they have lost so much as a of their military and their might, and so much was destroyed inside Israel over the span of this war, that they going back to the status quo of the end of 2006 shows a bigger defeat for the Zionists. Now, he started his speech saying that he didn't speak immediately after the ceasefire came into effect because he wanted to see what the Lebanese people of the south, of the Bekaa, of all of the areas that were evacuated, returning to their homes, how do they view this moment? So he doesn't speak in a manner of propaganda or popularism. He wanted to see what do the people feel this day. And seeing that at 4 a.m. exactly, when the ceasefire came into effect on the 27th, that hundreds of thousands of Lebanese driving back to their villages and towns all across Lebanon and going all the way to the border and seeing the voices of these locals that are standing on the rubble of their homes saying this is for the resistance and is basically a sacrifice that for the resistance, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the martyr secretary general of the Hezbollah, and seeing even mothers that have given their sons as martyrs in this battle, saying that their sons are a sacrifice for the resistance and the honor of this country, assured him that when he would say that this is a victory for Hezbollah, that he wouldn't be just speaking in populist manners.
Before we get into the question of victory and so forth, I think arguably, at least for the Palestinian people, not necessarily for the Lebanese people, but for the Palestinian people, the most important aspect of this ceasefire is that Hezbollah agreed to it, or the Lebanese government did, with the tacit assent of Hezbollah's leadership, even though the genocide in Gaza is continuing. Now, I've already done a report on this. I spoke to Marwa Azman, and I'm going to repeat briefly what I said in that interview. Given what Lebanon has suffered and was being made to suffer by this genocidal regime, destroying, cities, villages wholesale, murdering medics, and so forth. One could hardly ask more of the Lebanese people than they've sacrificed. They've sacrificed more outside of Palestine, of all the groups outside of Palestine who have fought to bring an end to this genocide. Certainly, I think any reasonable observer would say the Lebanese people have sacrificed more by a wide margin. Nonetheless, however, there is the reality that a major source of pressure on the Israeli military and the Israeli economy has been alleviated, and namely that those were the attacks by the Islamic Resistance on Israeli military targets in primarily in the northern part of occupied Palestine. So what do you think this means for the people of Gaza, Palestinians in general, but particularly the people of Gaza?
Well, I would say there's two things that we need to focus on to understand really this moment. Number one, that not only did the Lebanese people give the most, as you described, to the liberation of Palestine and support of the Palestinian people suffering the genocide, but that actually Hezbollah suffered huge, huge blows. whether it was the Pager terrorist attack or the assassination of much of the leadership of Hezbollah, the organization, while it was able to maintain its ability to defend the country and to raise the status of its attacks, as we saw over the last 60 days, on very important targets inside the Zionist colony and the waves of missiles and so forth, this doesn't negate the fact that they actually suffered huge blows. It is important to recognize that. I think if the military of Russia suffered the blows that Hezbollah suffered, it would have collapsed. This is not also exaggeration or populist propaganda. This is the truth. It's important to admit the enemy's successes and abilities, even if they are monstrous. It is monstrous, the terrorist pager attack, but it was a huge blow to Hezbollah. And to for the party to be able to still fight man to man on the front for 60 somewhat days and defeat all the elite units of the empire combined, because it wasn't only Israeli soldiers fighting on the ground there, okay, along with mercenaries. And this is happening also in Gaza. It is a victory for the Hezb. But also, the Hezb, I am sure, is wanting to be able to resupply itself and reorganize itself, reacquaint itself to its new leadership in all the positions that had to be replaced, and figure out how to prepare for the next round. And this is the second thing that we need to remember. This is a supposed ceasefire for 60 days. That brings us to the presidency of Trump. What this is, this is a respite on this front for now, for 60 days, until the new emperor comes in and activates the new plans. And the third thing, and I'm going to throw it here, and maybe we'll talk about it in as we go on in the show here, is as we see the war now has expanded to Syria, and Netanyahu in his speech accepting the ceasefire clearly indicated that the next target is Syria and President Assad of Syria, and followed by that, Iran when Trump comes in. And within moments of Netanyahu making that speech, the Wahhabi death squads in Idlib and northern Aleppo, armed with Ukrainian drones, covered by Turkish artillery, attacked the Syrian positions around Aleppo and the M5 highway, and have been invading for 3 days now, confronting the Syrian military, who at this moment, its most loyal ally, Hezbollah, is busy protecting the south of Lebanon and has suffered such a huge blow that it can't come to its aid. And where Russia is busy with a huge war in Ukraine, and where Iran is also busy across the whole region trying to defend other fronts. Those are, very important things we have to think about when we, yes, the Palestinians right now are more vulnerable. And to tell you the truth, there will be an acceleration of the genocide of the Palestinian people in these 60 days from before the coming of Trump. But given, as we see in Syria, things how they're moving, maybe the axis of resistance is going to stop allowing Israel and the West to set the pace of this war and move into a different case. But I've been saying this for a year and more since the beginning of this war, and I don't know the decision makers in the Axis of Resistance if they, what is in their mind, not moving in such direction.
Right. In that regard, I just want to point out that I believe it was yesterday, or it was some point after the ceasefire went into effect. The leader of Ansar Allah in Yemen, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badr al-Din al-Houthi, gave a lengthy speech in which he praised in considerable detail the sacrifices of the Lebanese people and the Islamic resistance. He had some choice words for the governments of the Arab world who have betrayed the Palestinian people. And then he talked about Ansar Allah's own contribution and said, I'm quoting here, our operations continue, and we always strive to escalate and enhance their impact. So certainly, Ansar Allah is signaling that it's going to maintain what pressure it can, may well try to escalate the pressure. Iraqi resistance groups, I haven't seen statements from them yet, the popular militias, but I wouldn't be surprised if they have a similar attitude. But for them to replace the pressure that was being applied by the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, they would have to dramatically increase their operations, their military operations against Israel. It's not clear that they have the capacity to do that in terms of the amount and nature of the weaponry available to them, and given how far they are from Palestine. Have you seen signs, seen indications from statements or otherwise from the groups in the militias in Iraq, the pro-Palestine militias, Ansar Allah, and Iran itself, that they are going to escalate their efforts to replace the pressure that has been lost by the ceasefire in Lebanon?
Well, obviously, we're all still waiting for the Iranian response to the last attacks on its territory and the injury of the Iranian ambassador in Beirut with the pager attacks. So this is going to happen, and Iran is not going to let down, it's built up for that. I don't know what they're going to do. If they definitely looking at the wider regional battle, things are moving fast, and I don't think even this ceasefire in Lebanon is going to last. I don't personally think it's going to last 60 days. If it lasts 60 days, that would be actually the Axis of Resistance will be setting itself for a direct attack from the US by that point. They have to take advantage of the chaos in the change of leadership in the US to change the reality here. Currently, also, another thing that I would say is that the Iraqi resistance is probably right now engaged directly on the battlefield in Syria against the Wahhabi death squads in the Aleppo region, and probably of protecting the flank around the Tanf area, the triangle between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan that the Americans occupy, that could at any moment also be waves of Wahhabi death squads attacking from there to cut off Deir ez-Zor from Damascus, from Homs, and then the country's cut off in half, like north and south. This is where, this is not one. We can't talk about Lebanon separate from all of this. We can't talk about Palestine separate from all of this. This is a multi-front war. The Russian military is currently bombarding the all the headquarters and bases of the Wahhabi death squads in Idlib and Aleppo, And you know, this the push of the into Aleppo city has been kind of stopped and is now being pushed back. The Turks are opening their borders again now for hordes of other mercenaries coming. And who knows what the Kurdish Contras are going to do in Deir ez-Zor under American directive at this moment. Syria is going to, and what's going to happen to Damascus? Is the Israelis going to attack from the Golan Heights? You see, now we're playing a bigger game. And unfortunately, the Palestinian people in this moment are being going to be left alone for a while, for a few, at least these 60 days. We're going to see inflammation of all the other fronts, maybe attacks on American bases and so on to weaken the Americans before Trump comes in. The genocide is going to continue with the Palestinians. And I don't blame the Axis of Resistance for this. I blame the Western public, Canadian citizens, American citizens, European citizens. Their blood of the Palestinian people is on their hands. There's nobody that's not guilty in the West. Because what is happening in Palestine is being done in the name of quote unquote Western civilization and Zionism, the official religion of Western states. That's all I can say about that. I'm getting angry, man. I'm getting angry. It's really it's a sad you know, there's a ceasefire. I'm happy for the people in the south. I went down. We can talk about that also. Too many locations. But it is a sad moment. The price that has been paid up until now to keep the hordes of white supremacy, the empire ruled from DC. The people of Bilad al-Sham, of Greater Syria, have been paying the hugest price to save humanity. Millions of people have been genocided in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine to keep these hordes away. Russia wouldn't be where it is today. And this is, I hope, our Russian allies remember this. The hordes would have been at the doors of Moscow if we didn't sacrifice here in this region to take the blows of the West and make sure they are not victorious here for over a decade now, a decade and a half. China wouldn't be where it is. I hope they remember our Chinese brothers and sisters. They would have been having to fight the Americans 15 years ago without their abilities that they have today if it wasn't for our sacrifices in this region. And the Western public as a whole would have been re-enslaved if it wasn't up for our sacrifices.
So I want to, I'm going to just part company with you on one point, Lathan, and that is, well, I think there is a lot of culpability to go around in the West, including amongst our fellow citizens from Western countries. I wouldn't go so far as to say that everybody is culpable, because there are some people who are doing everything they can to put a stop to this war. But having said that, and this is something that I intended to say during our discussion today, whether or not you express the sentiments you just expressed, now that the Lebanese people have made this sacrifice, and as I said, it's more than anybody could demand of anybody, it really is time for us to step up to the plate here in the West, because we've not done that. There haven't been enough people demanding enough of their governments and using all the tools that are at their disposal to make those demands. For us to make a difference. You know, with all of the protests, I commend people who've protested, but that clearly has been grossly inadequate to stop our governments from supporting this genocidal entity. We now need to up our game dramatically and begin to make the kinds of sacrifices that are necessary to put a stop to this horror, because it is being done in our name. It is absolutely, and it couldn't be done without the support, the material support, the legal support, the political support of our governments. Israel is, as we have discussed, a geopolitical pipsqueak. And although it likes to claim that it's able to dominate the region based upon its own inherent superiority, this is, of course, nonsense. It is an instrument of Western power. And without Western governments' multifaceted support, which Western citizens allow Western governments to give to Israel, there's no way that Israel could get away with these crimes. So we have a responsibility in the West to step up. And to those of you who have not done your part, who might be listening, I implore you, please, before it's too late and this genocidal regime achieves its evil, satanic objectives, do whatever you can to put a stop to this. In any event, I had to get that off my chest. I want to talk to you about the reality of this ceasefire, Laith. So there was an interesting poll done by Channel 13 News in Israel. It came to my attention because of a tweet by Professor Mohamed Marandi, whom you and I have both interviewed, we know personally. And the poll showed that 61% of respondents believed, this is in Israel, that Israel didn't win the war with Lebanon, the Islamic resistance and other resistance groups in the country. And only 26%, basically a quarter, said that it did win. What are your, and looking at it from the objective, from the perspective of the stated objectives of the Zionist entity, right? What were its objectives? How do you assess this? Did it win? Did it lose? Was it a draw? And if so, whatever your view may be, could you explain to us why you have that view?
Yeah, well, when you are defending against a much larger, much more powerful enemy as the imperial hordes that, and with the Zionist colony, you know, a draw is a win. There's no such thing as a draw in that situation. A small group of militia fighting these hordes and not allowing them to move into Lebanon for 60 somewhat days, that's a win. That's a victory for Hezbollah. Now, at the other hand, the opinions of the Zionists, why they think that they didn't win is because in their mind, they wanted a full-out genocide. These are genocidal populace of the Zionist colony, that anything other than what they see in Gaza, they consider a loss. Okay, they don't count their wins by military victory on ground against an armed enemy. They count their wins by a number of innocents that they killed. Saying all of that, it still is a, you know, we can't get also stuck in our head about this victory. It came at a huge price, and the genocide continues in Gaza. And the Hizb is going to take a while to return to the full health. It is coming back fast. But as we see, the enemy is moving to other parts of the battlefield and instigating, trying to cut off the resupply of Hezbollah, basically, by achieving what they couldn't achieve in the 10-year genocide in the Syria that people like to call the Arab Spring. So Syria is another nation that has given martyrs for Palestine. That 500,000 Syrians that died over that decade, who mainly Syrian soldiers, 300 something thousands Syrian soldiers died in that war, died as martyrs for Palestine. That's the only reason Syria is attacked. The millions of Iraqis that we saw dead is for Palestine. And so are the millions of Yemeni and Libyans and Algerians and Egyptians that have died over the last few decades. Those are all martyrs for Palestine. This is a much bigger war. I don't know. I was more optimistic a few months ago in terms of how fast the Zionist colony could collapse, but it is done, it's collapsed. There's no coming back from this point for the Zionist colony in terms of its stature, or even the word Zionism now is a curse across this whole planet on anyone. And the question is, will the US try to make an example of the Arabic people to scare China and Russia? How far are we going? Are we going to use nukes against Iran? I mean, this war is not going to be slow or easy.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Leith, as I discussed with Marwa Osman this week in an interview we published yesterday, the genocidal regime said that its primary objective in invading was to ensure that Hezbollah could not strike bases and settlements in the north of occupied Palestine. Well, it's failed miserably to do that, even if, as I understand this ceasefire deal, and it's interesting that the actual terms haven't been published as far as I know, but there have been reports which apparently are based on information leaked to the media by the US government, Israel, perhaps the Lebanese government, that certainly Hezbollah is not destroyed. No one is demanding or expecting that it's going to be disarmed by the Lebanese army. That was something that was being talked about for months by this character, Amos Hochstein, the US envoy who used to serve in the Israeli military. That's not happening, however. And we know it's clear beyond any doubt that even if Hezbollah moved all of its missiles north of the Litani River, it could easily continue to strike into northern occupied Palestine. In fact, it could strike into the Negev, it could strike Ashkelon. There's really no target beyond the reach of its missile forces. Whether or not they move to the north of the Litani River. So, and as I pointed out in my discussion with Marwa, the mayors of northern settlements like Kiryat Shemona and Metula are condemning this ceasefire as a surrender deal. That's what they called it. And one thing that's really interesting to me, Leith, I don't know that either of us is really in a position to say anything concrete about this, but I wonder, I'm sure that part of the motivation for entering into the ceasefire, and even Netanyahu had to admit it, was that his army needs a break very badly. It's taken a beating. He didn't say beating, but he did say they need to rest. They need to recover from more than a year of brutal warfare. And he even mentioned the fact he claimed that there were delays in the delivery of weapons. Now, that may just have been a swipe at Joe Biden, whatever. But it seems to me, Leith, that at some point, these murderers were going to run out of bombs and air defense missiles. And I think that the resistance has probably forced them to consume gigantic amounts of munitions and air defense missiles. And of course, there is the absolutely stunning and horrifying amount of bombs that they've dropped on Gaza. They don't have an inexhaustible supply, the West. And in addition, they've been giving gigantic amounts of weaponry to Ukraine. So I suspect, I can't prove it, that part of the motivation for this is they were on the verge of running out of weapons. And it's going to be some time before they have replenished their stockpiles. So this is probably you mentioned the blows that Hezbollah has taken. No doubt it has taken serious blows. But the Israeli regime is also greatly weakened right now. And the West is particularly weakened right now. And everything that's going on in Ukraine is just making it worse. So I personally, Laith, have not changed one iota my assessment that it's over for the genocidal regime and it's over for the West. My concern is that this is going to take longer than perhaps we had hoped, and that this means that more innocent people will be murdered by the genocidal regime before it is finally brought to its knees. Before we move on, I want to talk to you some more about Syria, but before we move on, anything you want to add in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, look, definitely they are defeated. There is no such thing as a Zionist military. It's just there's a Zionist Air Force, okay? And the factories were destroyed by Hezbollah, specifically in the last 60 days. The destruction of all the military factories in Haifa region and around Tel Aviv, meant that the Israelis were becoming almost 100% dependent on the arms deliveries. So that was not enough. That meant that they were running out of what they have as quotas that they have to fire every day. They had to cut down, okay? Otherwise they're gonna, find themselves unable to fight this war. And the other thing is that the amount of anti-air missiles that they fired has no parallels since World War II. Thousands upon thousands of missiles fired over this 14 and a half months, almost 15 months now, unheard of since World War II. So yes, this is putting a lot of strain on the West, but as we see, the way that the enemy is fighting this is multifaceted on multi fronts. And sure, Hezbollah won this war, but it's weakened. And at this moment of its weakness, the attack comes on Syria. We're going to discuss it a little bit more, but that's really what's happening. We can't, yes, we're still resisting, but we haven't fully won this war, and it's going to take a while.
Okay, so let's talk about this thing. You've already covered a lot of the ground I wanted to cover in regard to Syria, but there's one specific thing I want to flesh out with you. There was a report in the Middle East Eye that, according to Turkish security sources, as the article describes them, the Syrian rebel assault near Aleppo is a quote unquote limited operation. And the article goes on to say that these sources say the operation seeks to restore the internal borders per 2019 de-escalation zone deal, but Ankara tried to avoid it. Now, the fact that these sources purport to know whether it's true or not, what they're saying, just park that for a second, that this is a quote unquote limited operation. That says to me that the Turkish security services are cooperating with these so-called Syrian rebels. And my understanding is that Turkey has a relationship with them and perhaps even some degree of control over them. You'd have to be, I think, living on planet Mars to believe that the timing of this assault on Aleppo is coincidental. It happened literally at the same moment. It began literally at the same moment that the ceasefire went into effect. This all suggests to me, Laith, that there's coordination going on between Erdogan and Netanyahu. Now, it may be indirect. Maybe they're not talking to each other, but somehow, some way, they're coordinating their efforts. And this is, like, to me, astonishing. This man, Erdogan, has to be the biggest blowhard in West Asia because of the rhetoric that he employs in denouncing the genocidal regime, while at the same time allowing oil to flow through his country to the genocidal regime. Apparently, according to Mohamed Mirandi, there's strong evidence that there are other forms of trade going on. What do you think the reality is here about Erdogan? How much do you think the Turks are in on this disgusting effort to exploit the situation and inflict even more suffering on the Syrian people?
Yeah, so Number one, these Wahhabi death squads in Aleppo and Idlib use the Turkish lira as their currency in the areas that they control, and they fly the Turkish flag. And Turkey has something like 60 somewhat bases in Idlib and Aleppo. And currently, their bases, the artillery there is firing on Syrian positions, opening the path basically for these death squads. And the drones that are being used are Turkish drones manufactured in Ukraine under license. So there is no, these contras cannot exist with without their sponsor, the Turkish military and Turkish intelligence and the Erdogan regime, and their masters in Washington, D.C., and Tel Aviv. Erdogan is just a clown, okay, and he's a sock puppet. Netanyahu and Biden have their hands up his behind, moving his mouth, okay? This is what's happening. This is here it's good to blame Russia, actually, for what just happened. I think it's sometimes important to make this clear. Russia is the one that stopped Hezbollah and the Syrian military from totally liberating Idlib. The battle in Sarraqib, where the Hezbollah destroyed the advanced Turkish military positions there and sacrificed 40 somewhat martyrs to keep that ground, it was only Russia that stood in the way of liberating Idlib city and ending the existence of the Wahhabi death squads in Idlib. That was the ceasefire that Russia negotiated in order to try to sway Turkey away from NATO and Ukraine at the price of the blood of Hezbollah and Syrian military soldiers. And what did Russia get in return from this two-faced sock puppet? They thought that they can put their hand up his behind to try to, puppeteer him a little bit. Look what happened. They got betrayed in Ukraine. They got betrayed right now in Syria. And so the Russian military and the Russian Air Force have a debt to pay today to Hezbollah and to the Syrian army. And they need to clean this mess up. Their Air Force has to work three times harder than it is working. Those air defenses that the Russians have been holding back should be handed to the Syrian military. Advanced missiles that have been used in Ukraine have to be given to the Russian, Syrian military in return for the services that Iran has provided with its drones and other technologies. This is, sometimes because the game in this region is not even just a war about liberation of Palestine, it's a world domination game. That includes all the players in the world. It becomes harder to analyze these battles individually. So people get, because they forget the bigger picture, like that I'm just telling you about.
Look, I would say, Leith, as long as until Turkey withdraws from NATO, nobody should assume that Erdogan or any other leader of Turkey is an independent actor. If you're a part of NATO, you are under the thumb of the U.S. government. End of story. And that's true of every single vassal state that is in NATO. I want to go back to something you've used a phrase repeatedly to describe these so-called Syrian rebels. You refer to them as Wahhabi death squads. I've seen reports which suggest that a lot of these terrorists aren't even of Syrian nationality. And by the way, for our audience's benefit, you yourself are partly Syrian and you know that country intimately well. So just so people understand, we're speaking here with someone who has tremendous knowledge Syria and its recent history in particular. What's your understanding as to where these terrorists come from?
Yes, so the elite units, and we saw them filming themselves, are basically all the Central Asian countries, the Stans, the Turkic, you know, Mongolic people, Uzbeki, Turkmen, and Uyghur, and others, and also Turkish fighters, Chechens, so all the Turkic peoples, okay? And that's the elite units that they have there. This is a remnants of Al-Qaeda and ISIS that came. And of course, you have all the Syrian mercenaries that have now grown up for a decade with no income except being a mercenary in these regions. So you know what this tells you also? It tells you China has a debt to pay to Syria also. We are taking the brunt of the Uyghur terrorists on our land. They're killing our people. China has to step up also. I am, by the way, a Syrian citizen. My father's side is the Syrian family. My mother's side are the Palestinian family. I consider myself both. I consider myself Arabic. And I'm from Deir ez-Zor. This is a frontline town that has fought the French occupation and the American occupation valiantly and given thousands upon thousands of martyrs for the sovereignty of our country. It is sad to see Syria in this situation again. It hasn't healed from that decade of darkness with these death squads.
So let's switch gears, Laith, and talk about this side of the pond. I want to share with you a video clip of a character by the name of Sebastian Gorka. Here is what I wanted to share with our audience, if you just bear with me for 1 second.
Well, as usual, the experts are out there lecturing us about a nation they don't really know much about, Persia, Iran, the head of state and his foreign minister, and other leaders of the fascist theocracy that is the revolutionary regime of Tehran are dead. What does it mean? Well, here's the good news. A little bit of problem for the regime. Got to replace them. Here's the bad news. Does it mean the good guys, the Persians who have been subjected to that theocracy since 1979, are in a position to take over? Not quite. To quote Joseph Stalin, when discussing the power of certain leaders, the Pope, yeah, how many tank divisions does he have? As long as the Pasdaran, as long as the Revolutionary Guard has control of the power ministries, the army, that's who's going to maintain control. How do you bring down a regime like that? Not with neocon intervention. Do what we did in the Trump administration. Swing-ching sanctions that brought the regime practically to the brink of economic collapse. And that's when the people can take over. In the meantime, the International Court of Human Rights has put out a warrant for Bibi Netanyahu and his Minister of Defense. Because Jews, right? Jews. How interesting that the Arab wife of George Clooney was heavily involved in that decision. The left, they're the anti-Semites. No. Sorry. They're the Jew haters. Just look at the campuses across America. Look at the squad. We stand by you, Israel. Do what needs to be done, especially when it comes to the biggest sponsor of state terrorism, Iran. God bless. Tune in tonight. Amazing show.
Frothing at the mouth. Incoherent psychopath is Trump's pick for national security advisor. Just so people know, he's apparently of Hungarian-British origin. There's some indication he worked for British intelligence for a number of years. And apparently his father was once given a medal by an organization identified as being of a Nazi orientation. And he then, after his father passed away, I understand, proudly wore the medal publicly. Quite apart from all of that, this man is spectacularly unqualified to opine on national security, not simply as a moral matter. He's completely devoid of any, even a modicum of human decency, but he's a raving idiot. Excuse me for being so blunt, but I couldn't imagine a person who is less qualified to be a national security advisor to anyone, let alone the President of the United States. What do you make of all of this, Laith? I mean, I'm sure I invite you to comment on him particularly, but the fact that this guy was chosen by Trump, where does that mean we're all heading in the months ahead?
Yeah, look, I mean, when you put him on, I couldn't believe that this person, number one, it was how they were speaking. It was incoherent, yes, but it was clearly he had four or five buzzwords and points he had been given in the script that he has to, and then told just rant it, right? Ranting in the car, kind of video on TikTok. But he couldn't put it all together in a coherent way. It was really bad propaganda. What does it tell us about where we're going? We are seeing the decay, the final moments of the whole empire that is Zionist. As again, Ibn Khaldun, that I may have referred to on one of your shows, would say about the rise and death of dynasties, states, and empires is three generations. And we are on the third generation of the imperial elite since the end of World War II and the imperial seat moving to Washington, D.C. So these are symptoms. When the empire cannot birth any leaders, not only as figures as top heads like Trump and Biden or Johnson in the UK or whatever, the Greens in Germany or Trudeau, all of these are unqualified people, but then you have everybody else that's around them. Okay, so all of this is symptoms of the full decay. The empire cannot birth elites that are coherent, that can do something. And this is going to accelerate the collapse of the empire with madness, with madness. Anyone that thinks that Trump's going to stop any wars are going to be slapped in the face really hard once he starts growing the wars. They are those who are around him. He's choosing are not only Zionists, but are actually Armageddonists that want to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque and build the temple on top of it, and drive us into a world war nuclear with China and Russia and Iran. So doesn't mean that they are crazy, that they don't have nuclear weapons, or that they can destroy humanity. They could. And this is where the responsibility for Western audiences. It's one thing for us to sit down and talk about the victories of the Axis of Resistance, or what victories of Russia, or the amazing advances of China. None of that is gonna save us, save humanity, if we're in a nuclear war. And that reality of a nuclear war being stopped is not gonna be stopped at the battlefield here, because the more we win, actually, as an axis of resistance, or the more China wins, or the more Russia wins, the more probability that these crazies will drive us into a nuclear war. So, what is the Western public gonna do? If the Western public doesn't take their responsibility seriously, no matter how many victories we have in the South and the East, we will all end in a nuclear holocaust People need to take their responsibility seriously and try to change the elite revolution. Revolution is the only path forward for the Western civilization to survive, for humanity to survive.
Yeah. I'm going to conclude our interview today by telling you a little anecdote, Laith. I was walking down the street yesterday, street you know very well, Sainte-Catherine in Montreal. I was heading to the gym, and I saw a camera crew from CBC, and I didn't recognize who they were. I just saw the CBC camera, and they had the microphone out, and they were about to start doing a report, and I walked up to them, and I looked at the three of them, and I said, "Do you realize that we are this close to a nuclear war? Why isn't your media organization talking about the threat of nuclear war? Please start doing your job." And I walked away. And I'm going to repeat what I said earlier. I couldn't agree more. We have to up our game. Citizens of the West, we are the ones who are allowing our governments to take us down the path to nuclear holocaust. Not just genocide of the Palestinian people, but a genocide of all humanity. That's where this is heading. And we have it within us to stop it if we rise to the occasion. So with that, Laith, I want to thank you again, brother, and please stay safe. I agree this war is far from over, although it would be...
If I can say one thing, Dimitri.
Sure, please do.
I have two reports coming out from the South that we produced over the last 2 days. You know, we had so much traveling that we couldn't have time to do them, but now they're going to be out today. But I would say, you know, over the last month, YouTube suspended our page for a week. It's back on now. TikTok, you know, just erased our page. Odyssey also banned our page. So we got hurt financially in terms of donations because of the drop in viewership over the last, you know, quarter of this month, and we are in the red. Where, you know, this month we produced 140 reports from the field in West Bank, Jordan, Lebanon, and we're going to continue. But we need all as many people to help us donations. We are, you know, really hurting from this. So please, people, go to freepalestine.video and donate. We need your help to balance our sheet this month.
And I'll put a link to the website in the description to this YouTube video. Thank you again, Laith, for speaking with us, and I look forward to our next conversation.
See you soon, Dimitri.